Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by Plexaderm. And a quick reminder, you can subscribe to us on any place they have podcasts, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, etc., all kinds of places that I've actually never heard of. So the world has so many complicated issues that we thought that we would reach out to that, you know, the super brain expert authority on all things. So we're going to try to contact today. We're going to call world expert on all things Tom Nichols and see if we can get him on to share his wisdom on all the things that are happening in the world. So let's give him a call.
Following total atomic annihilation, the rebuilding of our great country will fall to experts like Tom Nichols. Unfortunately, Tom cannot take your call right now, but you can leave a message on this Vault-Tec answering system. Please leave a message when you hear the beep and have a great Vault-Tec day.
At the tone.
Well, apparently we're going to have to call him back. Apparently he's out experting or something. So let's try via Skype. Just try this here. Tom Nichols. Tom Nichols, are you there?
I am here, Charlie. Glad to be with you.
Well, this is the wonders of modern technology. It is good to talk with you. Look, I do want to talk to you about this this National Review hit job on you, Meet the World Expert on All Things Tom Nichols, which begins, "Hello, I'm Tom Nichols. I have very fierce facial hair," which gives you a sense of what the tone of the piece is. And by the way, what is the definition of fierce facial hair as opposed to just regular facial hair?
I don't know. I mean, it's such a weird piece, and the facial hair triggers a lot of people. I mean, you'd think, I mean, it's like I'm Seb Gorka or something with the facial hair, and you know, it's just a Van Dyke. It's a goatee and a mustache. So, but it does tell you, you know, they didn't go after my wardrobe because, as we know, I'm impeccable about my wardrobe, but they didn't like my comments about wearing shoes on airplanes, which National Review apparently now thinks is authoritarian, which has really come a long way from the
I actually think that this is your populist streak, the no shoes on airplane thing, because like the average person who's flying on an airplane, if the average person flies, which they do, this is the part of the problem, right, is that the average person does fly on airplanes and they have no idea actually how to do it. So they're, you know, they all look like they just would you say they just got out of prison the day before?
I'm just trying to help, Charlie, and yeah, I'm a giver, and people just don't want the advice.
Okay, so we're gonna come back to all of that. Among the things that annoy me, and it's not necessarily in the scale of things that morally ought to annoy me, like, you know, bigotry and things like that, but just flat out stupidity and stubbornness, or stubbornness and stupidity bothers me. Do you have any thoughts about what the hell's going on over at Bloomberg Law that they are not backing off on what is clearly a bogus hit job on the guy that worked for the Department of Labor? You know what I'm referring to, the claim that it was an anti-Semitic post. There is not, and as far as I can tell, there's not another human being on earth that does not work for Bloomberg Law that does not recognize this as satirical and the opposite of anti-Semitic, and yet they are doubling down, standing by their reporting. And I just, it's annoying that people have no sense of humor. It's annoying that they do these hit jobs. But there's something peculiarly, you know, annoying about the stubbornness in the stupidity of a decision like this.
What's really interesting about that as well is there isn't any constituency for this particular piece. I mean, this piece has been raked over the coals by Vox, Medium. I mean, you know, but
everybody,
the right and the left, everybody understands that this person screwed up, that this was, you know, a cheap shot. I don't understand why Mr. Olson resigned. I don't think he should have. I think this is one case just to prove that those of us with Trump derangement know right from wrong. I think this is one place where the president should have refused to accept his resignation. And, you know, all the adults should have gone on with their lives. But I do think that it's indicative of a culture, and I'm not going to pin this on Trump or anybody else. It's indicative of a culture that's been brewing for a long time that says, I can never be wrong. And when confronted with being wrong, I must double and triple and quadruple down. Not because I think some of it is people do this saying, it's not because I'm not wrong on this issue, but if I admit that I'm wrong on this issue, then it, you know, it will never end. Then it will set a precedent where I have to keep admitting I'm wrong. And so you just double down and weather the storm. And you see this on both sides of the aisle. I mean, the president is the master of just doubling down and waiting for it to blow over. But, you know, Ralph Northam and the people in Virginia, right? Governor Northam. I probably should resign. It was a terrible thing. And then said, nah, I'm not going to resign. It'll blow over. And, you know, he was right.
That's right. And that really did set kind of a precedent, which is that, hey, if you don't do, if you use a different playbook and you don't apologize and you don't resign, you can, in fact, survive. And I'm guessing that a lot of people looked at Ralph Northam and said, yeah.
The public's attention span is, you know, measured in milliseconds now. And so things will move on. But this Bloomberg piece, you know, really wrecked somebody's life over nothing. And I think that, you know, I think, again, in an adult culture where we are a little more stoic and level headed, you know, Mr. Olson would go back to his job. Bloomberg would retract and apologize. And, you know, the young reporter involved would be chastened and learn a hard lesson, and everybody would move on with their lives. And instead, you know, we have to dig into this trench warfare, and it's insane. I mean, it really is a sign of a dysfunctional culture.
So I wanted to talk to you about Jim Mattis and Jim Mattis's new book. I have not read the book. I don't know that you've had a chance to read it, but I want to comment. And now, of course, you are a professor at the Naval War College, and every time we have you on, you point out that you're not speaking for the Naval War College, but there is a certain relevance to all of this. I wanted to start off with this this point that James Homan makes in the Washington Post this morning, his big idea. And it's a quote from Mattis in this new memoir. If you haven't read hundreds of books, you are functionally illiterate and you will be incompetent because your personal experiences alone are not broad enough to sustain you. Any commander who claims that he's too busy to read is going to fill body bags with his troops as he learns the hard way. And so the book is, you know, call sign Chaos, Learning to Lead. It is not the tell-all book that I think a lot of people were hoping and expected to be. But the contrast between that attitude and the president of the United States, the commander-in-chief, is so stark. And Homan points out there are no shelves of books in his office in Trump Tower. It's, you know, clearly this is not a man who reads. Whether he's ever read a book in his life, we cannot tell. But it is an interesting comment from Mattis here about, you know, what a leader needs and what knowledge you have in order to command and make decisions.
I'd go even further and say it's not just what a leader needs, it's what a citizen needs. You know, I think I loved that comment from Mattis. I will say that I would not tell the average person you must read, you know, hundreds of books, but you should read dozens of books. You shouldn't be able to get out of high school without reading a few dozen books. And I think that does make us better people, because one thing reading does is it takes you out of yourself for a moment. And we need that now. We spend way too much time living in our own heads, having conversations with ourselves, admiring our own cleverness. There are, you know, writers we could name that we referred to earlier. I think, you know, reading just forces you to not have a constant dialogue with yourself over and over again. It forces you to hear someone. It's not just other people's views. It's to hear someone else's voice. I mean, even when I read a book I agree with, you know, I was thinking the other day, I was rereading something that I'll just name drop and say something Jean Kirkpatrick once made me read because she used to teach it in her class, Jean-Francois Revel, How Democracies Perish. And even though I agree with just about, you know, every page in the book, and I thought it was wonderful, it's someone else's voice speaking to me across the miles and across the years. And I think people have lost that. It's all about the immediacy of what I think, what I feel, what I want. And books really take you out of that. They make you transcend yourself, if only for the time that your eyes are resting on that page. And I think that's really important.
And Mattis, I like this line. He said, living in history builds your own shock absorber because you'll learn that there are lots of old solutions to new problems. Strategy is hard unless you're a dilettante. You must think until your head hurts. And again, the a lot of his criticisms or the contrast with Donald Trump are implicit in that particular way. So give me your take on his reticence. He's been on one show after another, and the theme seems to be the frustration of trying to get him to say something about the current commander-in-chief. He was on Morning Joe. They kept, you know, sort of hectoring about this. The entire interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic is Jeffrey Goldberg's frustration in trying to draw out some candid remarks about the commander-in-chief from Jim Mattis. And he just feels that he cannot speak about the current president of the United States, this military code. Is he making the right decision?
No, I don't think he is. I understand it, but I disagree with it. Because I think, and I don't speak for Jim Mattis or anybody else, my guess is that Mattis took the job saying, I will do this as a matter of national duty. I will become Secretary of Defense as, you know, part of the circle of adults that will limit the damage from this ignoramus. And I will do it in an apolitical way. Well, there is no such thing as an apolitical cabinet secretary. Once you're a political appointee, you are a political appointee. You are representing the president. You are representing the president's line. You have lost your virginity at that point, your political virginity, and you can't get it back. You know, there's that great line in Bull Durham where, you know, the kind of local tart is getting married and she says, "Do I deserve to wear white?" And Susan Sarandon says, "Honey, we all deserve to wear white." Well, that's not how politics works. That once, you know, once you've crossed that line, you don't get to go back and wear white again. And I think what Mattis is trying to do is say, look, I was never political. I executed this function as SecDef in an apolitical way. And then I stepped down and I'm going back to being an apolitical general. And I just don't, you know, I understand that he thinks he's doing that. But once you have your picture taken as a member of the cabinet, you are political. You are a political appointee. And as such, I think I respect the part where he says, look, I was a cabinet secretary and the stuff I said to the president is between me and the president. But that's different than saying, but I'm also not going to criticize because generals shouldn't criticize. I think that's a dodge. He's no longer a general. He's a former Secretary of Defense. He is a former cabinet official who is now a civilian, who is now part of our political life. He has every right, and I think every duty, to speak up about policy and what he thinks is right or wrong. I don't think that means that he should have to tell tattletale and tell secrets and rat out stuff that he and the president said in private, because I do think every president, even this one, has a right to executive privilege and to the best advice from his subordinates, spoken in confidence that he can get. That's very different than saying, I'm going back to being a general and generals don't criticize. I'm sorry, but with all the respect in the world to Secretary Mattis, he is no longer a general. He is a former Secretary of Defense who was confirmed by the Senate as a political appointee of the president. And it's time to start acting like a citizen who was a political appointee rather than trying to cloak oneself in the apolitical general costume that it simply doesn't fit anymore.
Do you think he'll change his mind before Election Day, or is this settled in?
I don't, you know, I don't know him, and I don't know him personally. I think, I hope he does. He strikes me as a man of incredible personal discipline. And so if he says, I'm not going to say anything, that means he won't say anything. It's also possible that the president is going to do something. The president's already done immensely dangerous things. It may well be that Mattis will finally reach the point where he feels he has to speak up.
Also, I think it needs a critical mass of others willing to step forward. Okay, switching very slightly, because there is a segue here, although it's not going to be necessarily apparent. You're watching what's going on in Great Britain right now, the meltdown of Boris Johnson's administration. It is an extraordinary scene. It's like in many ways it's parallel to the United States, where we're seeing this shambolic populist governance. In many ways, very very different, because Boris Johnson has lost control of Parliament. He is the Prime Minister. You had dissenters in the Conservative Party who voted against him on the Brexit issue. Conservative members of Parliament who did something that Republican members of Congress are incredibly reluctant to do. And as a result of all of this, nobody knows what's going to happen, except that it apparently now. Boris Johnson is going to fire a bunch of these MPs from the Conservative Party. They have the ability to do that with a centralized control, including, and this is where irony meets symbolism meets I don't know what, he is going to fire, basically expel, excommunicate Winston Churchill's grandson from the Conservative Party. And Boris Johnson's a guy who's written a biography, a book about Winston Churchill. So Winston Churchill's grandson is being thrown out of the Conservative Party for standing up to Boris Johnson. I mean, we live in extraordinary times, don't we, Tom?
You know, it's not a surprise that this would happen in Britain when you consider that Republicans have basically excommunicated some of their, you know, the entire legacy of Ronald Reagan and the people and ideas that they once would have stood for, with, you know, people like Amash and Hurd and others just kind of walking away from their seats. What's happening in Britain, I think, is mirroring what's happening in the United States, which is that populism is a really great vehicle for expressing irrational and ignorant rage, but it's a really lousy vehicle for governing. And I would add, you could throw in Italy into this, which, you know, thought it had, you know, that the populist millennium had come, and Steve Bannon was running around thumping his chest about the new, you know, the new European politics. And of course, all of it's falling apart. Populism is dumb. Populists can't govern. They've never been able to govern. It always mutates into this kind of hot dumpster fire, this hot mess of a dumpster fire. And I said early on, I didn't think that the Brits would make their deadline for Brexit, and I'm not sure that they'll make this one. I'll just say this is an unusual position for conservatives like us to be in, because I don't know about you, Charlie, but I was not a huge fan of the establishment of the European Union. You know, I was like, oh, great, a big transnational quasi-socialist bureaucracy rooted in Brussels. Boy, you know, there's the answer to a question nobody was asking. On the other hand, the European Union, after 25 years, has contributed to a Europe that is whole and free and economically much more viable. Well, you know, if people want to take apart the European Union, there are ways to do it, I think, that are kind of a velvet divorce. What the Brits did was go on a drunken bender and decide, you know, 48-52, that voting for this was going to make all the Muslims leave and get the French out of, you know, their soup about what kind of cheese they could eat and all that stuff. I mean, they just didn't know what they were voting for. And so now that they do know what they're voting for, they're all mad at each other. I kind of hope they actually have another election or another referendum, which, of course, the Brexiteers hate and fear as anti-democratic. But, you know, at this point, this will not end well, no matter how.
No, and there's some horrible scenarios, including Jeremy Corbyn becoming Prime Minister of Great Britain, which is, you know, several floors below the worst case possible scenario. But I do think it's also interesting watching the rise of people like, you know, demagogues like Nigel Farage, who seems very sort of the British, you know, Trumpian style, Steve Bannon like grifter. Somebody who is, you know, not taken seriously by serious people at all, and yet has this tremendous influence now over the economic and political life of Great Britain.
Well, interesting. It seems that Farage, like Bannon, like others, like some of the Italian coalition partners, their star is fading already. Because again, it's a great stump speech to kind of piss people off and get them to the polls. But 6 months later, you know, that you can't just keep giving that same speech in place of actually governing. And I think, you know, I think it's actually notable the degree to which Farage seems to almost have been pushed aside at this point, because now we're really getting down to the crunch time. And you know, the speeches aren't fun anymore. You know, this was all a great joke the morning after, while everybody was still kind of hung over and rubbing their foreheads and marveling at the incredibly crazy thing they'd done. But that was, you know, that was a long time ago. Now they actually have to get something done.
Okay, so I want to talk to you about this, the whole enemy of my enemy is my friend politics in both the general election context and in Republican politics. And I think you know what I'm talking about here. Also want to talk about, if you're willing to, talk about this sort of bizarre hit piece in National Review about you. If you're game for that.
Sure.
So let's do that in a moment. But first, let's hear a word from our sponsor, our friends at Plexiderm.
Okay, picture your face in the mirror. Do you see all those wrinkles around your eyes? How about the crow's feet or those large under-eye bags? Now imagine they're gone. I'm not talking about some risky, expensive surgery, just gone in minutes. It's called Plexiderm, a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates your wrinkles, crow's feet, and under-eye bags in minutes. It's the edge you've been looking for. Plexiderm can give you the confidence you'll need to be yourself at work or out with friends, and the best part is, Plexiderm goes on clear so nobody will know you're using it unless you tell them. Go to tryplexiderm.com and use my code BULWARK for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an additional $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning code word BULWARK. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use code BULWARK at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com.
All right, we're back with Tom Nichols. So let's talk about the politics of the enemy of my enemy is my friends. I've written about this with Joe Walsh, who I personally like and has been a guest on this podcast. But the idea of supporting him for president, I think, is absolutely ludicrous. And unfortunately, and I think you've probably experienced this as well, I mean, I'm haunted by the sense that this is one of the ways that we got to where we are right now, making alliances with people that we really should not have gotten in bed with. And I'm sure we all have this long list of people that we associated with or that we you know, kind of put our arms around because, okay, we were on the same side of the war and that didn't work out well. Now, you have also kind of taken a position, a very strong position, a very controversial position, that you're going to vote for any Democrat against Donald Trump, no matter who he is, including Bernie Sanders. And of course, this has raised a lot of eyebrows because you're a self-described conservative, and yet you're saying that as long as, you know, the enemy, my enemy, which is Bernie Sanders, is the enemy of Donald Trump, who's also your enemy, he is your friend. So, how comfortable are you with saying that, you know, that you will walk in that voting booth and possibly put a socialist in charge of the United States?
Well, I already voted for Hillary Clinton, so my, you know, gag reflex has been pretty well suppressed early on. I think, let me say two things. One about Joe Walsh. I actually kind of admire Joe for coming out and saying, look, I screwed up. I said a lot of crappy things. I got on the wrong side of a lot of issues I shouldn't have, and I'm sorry. And I have learned a lesson. And so I think that's great. And I don't think, I'm tired of people piling on Joe Walsh about, well, you said this and you said that. The man stepped forward. He said, I've apologized. I was wrong. I want to make a fresh start. I don't think that should lead to a primary challenge because I am trying to be completely strategic about removing Donald Trump. I'm not going to do what feels good. I want to do the things that have the highest probability of removing the president legally and constitutionally by the electoral process from office, which leads to my second point. How comfortable am I if I had to vote for Bernie Sanders? I don't even drink, and I would probably have to go on a bender for a week just to do that. Nonetheless, here's the difference. I think Bernie Sanders, I lived in Vermont. I don't think very well of Bernie Sanders, but I think he would observe the Constitution. I think the people around him would act within the boundaries of the law. I think that they would be almost hamstrung by their own commitment to transparency, which is fine by me. I think Bernie Sanders would be a very ineffective president and would probably not get done half the things or 90% of the things that he's ever talked about. And it would be a miserable 4 years where I would just criticize him for being a basically a silly old man living in the 1960s. I will still take that over the purposeful destruction of our constitutional norms by Donald Trump, and particularly by William Barr, who I think has emerged as the most dangerous member of the Trump cabinet, who has really, you know, I mean, at this point, I would almost vote for anybody just to get rid of William Barr. So, you know, to say, well, you'd vote for a socialist. Yeah, Bernie, I guess, is about as socialist as a Vermont senator can be. He's got about as much chance of turning the United States socialist as he does putting it under Sharia law.
Okay, so you wouldn't be supportive of Jeremy Corbyn if it was an enemy of my enemy type thing. And if you were in Great Britain, since we were talking about that before the break, would you vote for the Labour Party if you thought that that the Conservatives had totally lost their minds?
No, there's a difference. First of all, Jeremy Corbyn is as, you know, evil and dysfunctional. I would say he's even, you know, I don't hold the president to a very high moral standard because I don't think he understands most of what he says or does. I think there's something wrong with the president. I think he has an emotional problem. Jeremy Corbyn is intentionally evil and knows what he's doing. And further, the British system being a parliamentary system means that the moment the prime minister gains power with a majority, he has immense amounts of power to get done what he wants to get done. I can tolerate all kinds of kooky presidents in the United States because we have a system of separated powers. What I can't tolerate is a kooky president who is intentionally lighting the Constitution and the norms associated with his Article II powers, lighting them on fire every day, and has a group of cronies and thugs around him who are intentionally enabling and abetting that. So I think, you know, comparing it to the British example, it is
yeah.
just wrong.
Yeah, no, of course, the president of the United States does have these sweeping powers. And I guess the argument that you got into with Noah Rothman on Morning Joe, which you and I have talked about before, where you're saying, you know, we have to, you know, get rid of Donald Trump by supporting any Democrat. And I think his point, and I certainly don't mean to speak for him, was yes, but, well, I don't know if there was a yes there, but that it's really important to hold them accountable as well. So wouldn't it be in terms of strategy, a more prudent step or a smarter step to be, you know, as a, you know, anti-Trump conservative, to be pounding on the Democrats? Don't lose your mind. Don't take these positions that are going to destroy you. I mean, Rick Wilson's out there, and I think he's tweeting it this morning, that if the Democrats nominate Bernie Sanders, they will lose 44 states.
Right.
I mean, isn't that important? If you want to get rid of Donald Trump, then isn't it, say, somewhat, I don't know, not the best move to give the Democrats a blank check?
But I'm not, Charlie, and I think we're talking about two separate things. First of all, Noah, you know, again, we're both talking about Noah, and he's not here, but Noah did not have a yes, but. There was no yes in Noah's answer. And I think, you know, I think Noah, like a lot of the conservatives, are saying, well, I'm not going to vote for Trump, but I won't vote for a Democrat either. Well, in this election, given the margins, and given the fact that the president has in the past declared our elections to be unfair and rigged, any vote that isn't a vote against Donald Trump is a vote for Donald Trump. And unfortunately, that's just the nature of a binary election this time around. Now, of course, you know, I always get this stuff about the Flight 93 election.
Well, that's right. I mean, aren't you basically arguing it's a Flight 93 election, but from the other point of view?
No, because the problem with the Flight 93 election argument was, vote for this terrible alternative, even though it crashes and burns a plane. I don't believe for one second that any of these Democrats, even Bernie Sanders, who I think of as mostly as a harmless kook, I don't think any of these people are going to crash the United States into the ground. I think that that's where we're already headed with Trump. And, you know, I actually think that I think of this as a return to normalcy. All of the I always think of the Democrats the way P.J. O'Rourke once described Hillary Clinton. She is awful, but within the normal parameters
yes,
of awful.
I, by the way, agree with that formulation exactly.
And so but Noah's point about giving them a pass. I'm not giving them a pass. I'm part of, you know, Rick and others. I'm part of that group where the Democrats are constantly jumping down my throat saying, you can't criticize us because you're on our side. And I'm like, no, I'm on the side of defeating Donald Trump. That doesn't mean I'm on the side of Medicare for all and opening the borders and, you know, taking guns and all the other stuff you want to do. I just think that the Democrats are much less of a threat to our constitutional system than Donald Trump. And again, this coterie of very clever enablers from Barr to McConnell to others that have taken over the executive branch of the government. And I say taken over, elected to, and now taking over very carefully the executive branch. So I don't cut the Democrats a break. I've been brutal on them. And I mean, look at the crap storm I went through the other day for making fun of Beto O'Rourke.
Oh, my. Yeah.
And I had to listen for 2 days to the Beto bros, who are just as bad as the Bernie bros.
They are.
How it was totally the coolest thing in the world that Beto O'Rourke dropped an F-bomb, you know, twice. You know, Beto O'Rourke is not a serious person. He is not a serious candidate. But if he's nominated, is he better than Donald Trump? Of course he is. In part, again, because people forget that the president is going to have to appoint people around him. And I am not worried about the people that I don't think there's going to be a William Barr. I said the other day, who could have thought that William Barr could make me nostalgic for Eric Holder?
Oh, I know. Okay, so, but let's go back to, and by the way, I agree with you on Beto O'Rourke. He really does come off as a callow, foul-mouthed child at this point. And even though and the fact that he thinks it's very cool that F-bombs are his path to authenticity is just a sign of, like, seriously, guy?
They're not even his path to 2% at this point.
Well, that is the irony. And, you know, my concern is that the Democrats are forming a bubble for themselves that's very, very similar to the bubble that we saw on the right, and that they don't understand how some of the things that they are doing are going to play in a general election, by which I mean in those states that will determine the Electoral College. But I want to go back to your point about the constitutional norms, and I want understand in the context of this conversation that I want very much to agree with you, but here's my concern. You're saying that you don't think that the Democrats pose as much a threat to the constitutional norms. And yet we have Democrats out there talking about packing the Supreme Court, abolishing the filibuster, abolishing the Electoral College. You have Kamala Harris, who's talking about, if Congress doesn't act on gun control, that she would feel free to use executive orders. Other Democrats are lining up and saying, yeah, we would also, you know, declare a national emergency on climate change. If these are not threats to the constitutional norms, then what would be? If Donald Trump was talking about these things, we would be in a full-scale, you know, conflagration. If Donald Trump was talking about, fundamentally changing our electoral system, packing the Supreme Court, declaring even more emergencies to, arrogate more power to himself. So, I mean, it feels naive to think that the Democrats do not pose a threat to the constitutional norms.
I didn't say they didn't pose a threat to our constitutional norms. They pose less of a threat to our constitutional norms. And they're also advocating things, you know, they're doing what candidates do. They're advocating things in parking lots in Ohio and Pennsylvania that they know never have a chance of being enacted, that they will never get a Senate majority, even if their party controls the Senate. This is red meat for their base during a primary. I think we're seeing a president in real time who says things like Article 2 means I can do anything I want. The courts are an obstruction. The media and the courts are, you know, anti-American institutions that must be defeated. The collusion with Russia, if they come to me again, if a foreign power comes to me again, I'll happily cooperate with them. I mean, these are things. If the worst thing that the Democrats are saying is, hey, we're going to try and pack the court and issue some executive orders about gun control, I know how to fight with that. I know how to fight with bad policy. You know, you and I have been doing that for our whole careers as conservatives. We know how to fight bad ideas and mobilize against them and, you know, create congressional majorities and do all that stuff. When you have a guy who says there is no difference between the truth and a lie, there is no limit to my personal power. All things are lies except the things I tell you. I'm sorry. That is an existential threat to, and I don't mean in the immediate, like the whole world's going to come crashing down in 2 years. I mean, 10 years from now, where we have just eaten away at the foundations of our democracy to the point where, you know, somebody like Donald Trump just becomes the norm, that we just become a nation of people who believe in nothing, have no connection to our constitutional principles, don't understand the rule of law, vote as basically just getting even with other people. I think it's disingenuous in the extreme to focus, as many of our colleagues do, to focus on the hypothetical damage a Democrat under the worst situation might do when the president is doing thermonuclear damage to our Constitution every single day.
Well, let me give you one of the arguments that that I hear, and I'm sure you had the pushback, which is that everything you're saying is true, but you know, but among the distinguishing characteristics of this president is his lack of knowledge and his lack of a work ethic. I mean, imagine if he was competent. Imagine if he was competent and he understood how government worked and did not spend all of his time watching television and tweeting. There's a great story in the LA Times, by the way, showing a president with plenty of downtime this summer who's you know, working less. He seems to care less about his job now than he did back when I was working for him, this one aide said. It looks like he's not even trying, but he thinks he's trying. To him, all the watching TV and tweeting is work, so he believes he's on the clock 24/7, 365. So to a certain extent, you know, he is less effectual than a hyper-competent progressive Democrat in the White House.
Well, first of all, I don't think of any of the people that are about to get elected on the Democratic side as hyper-competent. Not only that, I'm a great believer in divided government. I mean, that's the other thing. I think people have been arguing that I have now become, you know, an arguing for some kind of permanent Democratic majority. I have said that I will throw in with the Democrats for at least one electoral cycle and until the last Trumpers are cleared out of the legislative branch. But I've said over and over again, I intend to, for the rest of my life, to aim for divided government, because we've had undivided government twice in the past 10 or 15 years, and I don't think it goes very well. So with that said, yeah, if Trump were competent. But here's the other thing people forget about. Trump is completely incompetent. He has no idea what's going on. But the people around him are getting more and more competent every day. And again, that's why I said William Barr and Mitch McConnell are the two most dangerous men in American politics right now. Between the two of those guys, we are burning down a lot of norms. I mean, think about the things that would have us in a full congressional or political or impeachment meltdown. I mean, the vice president of the United States just flew clear across Ireland to stay in a hotel owned by the president and then went on television and said, well, we had to do it because of my security retinue. The attorney general is going to drop $30,000 to have a party at the president's hotel. These are so small now that we don't even think about them, that these are so tiny that in the big scheme of things, we've just become numb to them, when any one of these would have been a Watergate-level scandal 25 years ago.
Yeah, in Earth 2.0, these would be consuming scandals. Okay, let's talk about something that is truly bizarre. I'm still trying to figure out what it's all about. National Review devoted a sort of satirical hit job to you by their critic at large, Kyle Smith. And I think I texted you yesterday about it. This is a sign that you've kind of arrived, yeah. Right? That here you have one of the premier magazines devoting a whole piece to attacking your fierce facial hair, the world expert on all things. What was it about?
I don't know. I me personally as yeah. The others do. And, you know, I'm always first to admit I'm a big, fat, ripe target for parody. I mean, I can be a real jerk sometimes. And,
but that's your brand, right?
But, you know, it's also who I am. I fall in love with the sound of my own voice on occasion. I get that from my father.
But you're a curmudgeon, right?
So I am a curmudgeon. So, you know, I thought, well, okay, there's going to be a hit piece on me. I mean, God knows, you know, I'm a target rich environment. And instead, this was kind of a Mean Girls sort of, you know, I mean, let me just say for the record, I didn't know who this guy was until this week. I'd never interacted with him. Never heard of him, never crossed swords with him about anything. And the only thing I reacted to, and I do want to make this point, I mean, he really went for this mean-spirited attack on Harvard Extension School, which I thought was really unkind and nasty. And he's doubling down on it even today. So that was the one part of it I responded to. But the rest of it,
let me just read what he wrote. And again, he's talking. He writes the piece in your voice, your super expert expertise. By the way, there are some funny lines. You know, The Max Boot line, I have to admit I laughed at, but okay. So he says, I want to know, this is your voice. I want you to know more about my super expert expertise. Oh, if you want to know more about my super expert expertise, I suggest you contact a little place they call Harvard where I teach. Well, not Harvard. It's something called, in quotation marks, Harvard Extension School, an online campus notable for its open admissions courses. The people who call this a, quote, glorified community college, unquote, are not funny and will be dealt with. Wikipedia notes that of the 500,000 students who've taken courses at the Extension School, 0.18% earned a degree. Do they need a degree, though? They got to bask in my awesomeness. I don't want to brag, but at Harvard Extension School, I hold the title of instructor. And it goes on. So, I mean, that's the last paragraph, kind of the shot about Harvard Extension School.
And, you know, the piece had a couple of funny lines, but a better editor would have chopped those last two paragraphs and said, you know, there's no point in going after that because, of course, like most extension schools, Harvard is not about, you know, it's not just a night version of the day school. It's a place where people take all kinds of courses. Yesterday on Twitter, I pointed out, for example, that I created, along with the Air Force, a certificate in deterrence studies that a lot of folks in the military and security fields are taking. So I think it was just, you know, for people that are, I think that this guy who went to Yale, apparently, for them, Harvard is like this trigger word that attacking it shows that they're down with the populist moves, and somehow, you know, it's because I never identify myself as a Harvard professor. When I say I've gone to, you know, teach at Harvard, I say I go there and I'm at Harvard Extension and I'm very proud of that. But it was just a weird flex all around. And it was also, I should say, evidence of yet another critic of the who hasn't read the book, because everybody thinks the book is about me and my expertise, when in fact the book is about the idea of expertise and why don't people understand and respect experts in their respective fields. But it was just lazy. I mean, it just kind of, the whole thing came across as,
this is the problem of writing a book called, you know, The Death of Expertise, in that if you don't read the book, it's essentially characterizes that you are claiming to be the super brain expert authority on all things, which was really not the point of the book.
Well, criticizing the book without reading it is one of the things I criticize in the book. You know, people who criticize stuff without reading it. So it was kind of like the piece is very meta. You know, in that it's like, by doing that, it's an example of the thing that I wrote about that he would have known about if he'd read the book. It was just a very strange thing. And, you know, as I told a few people, National Review thought I was pretty smart when I was writing for them. As you say, it completes my A-list credentials and my final excommunication from the conservative movement or something. But
I haven't tweeted extensively about this, but my initial reaction was, well, now do Seb Gorka or do Jared Kushner. Where's the takedown on Laura Ingraham or yes. Tucker Carlson? I mean, that they, listen, this is no disrespect, because you're on Morning Joe a lot more than me. Okay, so you know, I tell my wife that I'm a C class, and you are definitely a B plus class. You know, in terms of the MSNBC punditry and everything. But I mean, they kind of had to reach down kind of deep to get you. I mean, to do a whole profile when we are living in the most. You think about in American history, the most target-rich environment for people that you want to lampoon. I mean, it's
funny you say that, Charlie. I had exactly the same conversation with my wife. I said, apparently National Review just wrote a hit job on me. My wife burst out laughing, and I said, right? You know, I said, in the world of, you know, outside the world of Never Trump punditry, but almost, you know, I'm visible if you're into nuclear weapons or military stuff, but I'm like, and I'm basically a C-lister, you know,
you're a B-lister. I'm a C-lister. You're a B-lister. I'm giving you the props. You know?
Really kind of scraping the barrel to say, we have to establish our anti-Trump credentials, our anti-never Trumper credentials to kind of reach down to this guy. which was sort of flattering, but, you know, I guess I was a little disappointed with the quality of the criticism, to be honest.
Well, Ben Howe, I think, and I saw that you retweeted him, I think he did nail it. He said, you know, you've been set up here because your brand is being an elitist curmudgeon, and they tricked you into writing an endearing defense of the Harvard Extension School. This time tomorrow, people will be calling you that, quote, sweet old man that works on making education more widely available, and you will be ruined.
Yes,
you've totally screwed your brand.
Well, as David Priest said, the only problem with Ben's comment was that no one would ever refer to me as sweet. But yeah, I don't know whether to thank the guy or not, but it was just a strange, I mean, I read it and I just thought, I wondered for a moment if it was a parody of a takedown. I had to read it twice to kind of get my head around where it was going. And then I got to the part about extension and I wasn't going to really answer that, but I thought, you know, smearing an institution where I work, just because you went to Yale and you didn't understand it and you've never dealt with that and or taught in such a program, was really over the line. And I still think he owes an apology to the people that went there, because I think that was just, it was just cheap.
Do you keep a bust of Lenin on your desk, Len?
I do. And you
okay,
know,
I just
wasn't wrong about that. I think I actually tweeted a picture of that. I got it in the Soviet Union in 1983 and I keep it on my desk. I think of it as a trophy of the Cold War.
You got a head on your desk. So.
Exactly. I mean, it's the equivalent of, you know, mounting a communist's antlers on my wall. But yes, it's a beautiful bust of Lenin. He's leaning and he has his finger holding a book open while he looks very thoughtful. And every now and then I look up and I say, gotcha. So I enjoy it. But yes, I do have a bust of Lenin on my desk.
The piece also accuses you of spending 100 hours a week on Twitter. Now, look, I say this to myself all the freaking time. Like, Charlie, your life would be better. You'd be smarter. You'd be happier if you were not on Twitter so much. You would read more books. You would actually enjoy more sunsets. You might actually talk to your wife. You'd play with your dogs more. Every part of my life would be better if I'm not on Twitter. So, Tom Nichols, do you ever think, I wish I wasn't on Twitter so much? Do you think you're on Twitter too much?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me this, because this time management question kind of made me chuckle. Yeah. I don't wish that I weren't on Twitter so much. I just wish other people weren't on Twitter. But, you know, let me make a point about time management.
The people say, mute button.
You don't do anything. You just tweet. I'm like, look, I teach at two major institutions. I write prodigious. I mean, the week that this came out, I had one piece in the Washington Post and one piece in USA Today, where I publish pretty regularly. I am waiting and working with an editor on my seventh book, which will, you know, is now getting started. After writing, you know, a bestseller that went into 12 foreign languages 2 years ago, if that's a time management problem, you know, Kyle and everybody else ought to have the same time management problem I have, working two jobs, writing multiple columns, and working on my seventh book.
Do you sleep? How do you do that?
I do have a barrel of my native soil nearby where I rest during some of the daylight hours. I sleep. I mean, I tend to be a night owl. I mean, I teach in the morning. I kind of hang in the afternoon and sort of get my energy up, and I do quite a lot of work. The other thing about the tweeting, though, that people don't understand, most people tweet from a phone, and I have a desktop with a 27-inch monitor on it where I have three things open at the same time. Like, I'm doing a lot of writing while Twitter kind of runs in a corner, and I have in fact, you can hear it, all that clacking, one of those cool mechanical keyboards that allows me to type very fast. So I keep Twitter open along with, you know, the thing I'm working on, along with some email from other places. And so people think that I'm doing a lot on Twitter because they imagine me just holding a phone and staring at it, whereas actually I'm sitting at a desk with four windows open doing three things at once. So
you don't have TweetDeck open, do you?
Yes, I love TweetDeck. I hate the Twitter app. I use TweetDeck.
Okay, so you basically are a high-functioning ADD guy.
That is exactly right. That is truer than you know, Charlie. It's exactly right.
I mean, you are doing all of this. I mean, it's just like, because TweetDeck actually, I will have it up occasionally in the morning just to look at it. And it, and frankly, and I do a lot of tweeting too. It stresses me out. It's just too much. It's like, no, I can't have it. You're saying you have TweetDeck plus three screens.
Plus,
which is like,
plus
wow.
My word processor, plus a browser, plus my email sitting there. And when I need a break from all of that, as some of my Twitter followers know, I close all that down and I play, Fallout or XCOM or one of the many games that a middle-aged man shouldn't admit to playing, but that I do. I'm also a very avid computer gamer.
And you have a very large refrigerator filled with monster drinks and Red Bull.
I'm sorry. The one thing I have in common with the president, I'm a total Diet Coke junkie.
See, everyone's going to want me to ask you this next question, though. Okay, that's all really impressive, but do you actually have a life? I mean, do you have a life? Do you have stuff?
I have a lovely wife. I have a teenage daughter who I am divorced, but she lives right down the street from me, her mom. I have a cat who demands my attention. In fact, when this National Review piece dropped, I was actually at the beach having lunch with my children and stepchildren and my wife and, frolicking in the surf. So I didn't really know that much about it until I got back. While I was wiping the sand from between
okay,
my...
Okay, this is good. The frolicking in the surf was because I was getting a little bit disturbed that, you're one of these guys who, just goes from the office to TV studios to the Twitter deck and stuff like that.
No, so. And that actually, the rest of it, I had my last cigar of the summer yesterday after.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
See, I'm sitting here having a podcast with you, and I'm thinking about this, and I'm looking at Twitter while I'm talking to see, I was sort of just seeing whether you were tweeting while we were doing the podcast, which I don't think you actually were, but you were thinking about it.
Yeah.
You've already planned your tweet. I'm going to go out there and I'm going to play with my dogs for a while and just sort of, consciously not engage because there's a point. Every once in a while, you think to yourself, okay, I have to do this now because we're in the midst of battle, but there's going to come a time when I'm going to be able to step back because the alternative is I'm just going to burn the freak out.
Well, someone said to me, someone who is was very angry with me, one of our former conservative colleagues who believes I'm a traitor, he said, you're going to be irrelevant one day. I'm like, dude, I'm almost 59 years old. I'm irrelevant now. I'm like in retirement planning. I'm already picking out, condos in Vegas. I'm looking forward to the day when I don't have to really care that much about the news and I, write the occasional piece or teach the occasional course. I mean, I always think of that line from The Godfather when Sollozzo says, "You think too much of me, kid. I had my shot." this is a kind of late life thing that I did not plan on doing. I didn't see Donald Trump coming.
No, I completely understand that. And I think to the extent that Donald Trump has a certain shamelessness, I mean, that his superpower is his shamelessness. I think that at a certain point, the not giving any more bleeps is also kind of a power. It's like, I'm irrelevant. I'm good with being irrelevant. I'm probably never going to be more irrelevant than I am right now. So,
I'll be irrelevant. My wife loves me. My daughter loves me. My cat loves me. And the rest of you can go piss up a rope.
Yeah, you probably should get a dog, though. The cats, I don't know.
We had such a nice chat. let me just say to all the dog people out there, I love dogs. I think they are noble, glorious creatures. My daughter has a Great Pyrenees. I love that guy. He's my favorite dog. I'm just not a dog guy. Cats, Dickens was all about cats. A cat sits on my desk, helps me with my grammar and punctuation, by staring at the screen. And also I don't have to walk a dog. I am a very lazy man, Charlie. And when a dog barks at 6 a.m. and says, I have to go outside and pee, I'm like, look, just go take a dump in the cellar. Don't involve me. I don't want to be involved. So cats are low maintenance, but I love dogs and I'm not an anti-dog guy.
I will not claim that dogs are low maintenance, although I do have a 130-pound German Shepherd who is at my feet, and he does not help me with my grammar, but he would probably eat your cat. So, I mean, just there is that. Tom Nichols, thank you so much for all of this time and a wide-ranging discussion. I'm gonna come out of the basement after the podcast and go do something in the real world now for a while.
All right. It was great talking with you, Charlie.
All right. Thank you. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. The episode today was brought to you by Plexiderm. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.